Hello. How you doing, Bob?
Good, good. Sitting here with Ankara. Hey, you haven't started the recorder yet, right?
Haven't started the what?
The recording yet?
I can turn it off. Hold on.
Got
Good evening, welcome.
Thank you.
Please play. Yes, we're on the phone. Please join me in saying the Anna Pakoa. Anna Pakoa. going to be reading from a verse from the Zohar, from section 2 of the Parashah Vayelech, reading verse number 8. Vayehi Noam Adonai Eloheinu aleinu maasei yadeinu kunenei aleinu maasei yadeinu kunenei. Vekoda begin bisarach vekura ovado. Vyagidila sarach tal tal ovado. Bachat ha'eit genish. Behavuzimna Adla Matun Yomo Vilaved Haki Bamishpa Viale Tipi Vyesh Nispe Vilo Mishpa Viala Fadina Tzedek Tzedolo Vadim Dimata Vime Viachara Venasi Vladiha Videhu Videhi. This is true if the man who is not her mate sinned in his actions, that he is taken out of the world when the time has come for her mate to marry her. Even if he did not sin much to be sentenced to death, nevertheless he dies then before his time comes to die. And it is not done according to judgment. Of him it is written, but sometimes ruin comes for want of judgment. The judgments of righteousness, which is Malkut, of the attribute of judgment, can contact him because of his sins. Because the time of the other, her mate, has come to marry her, because she is his, even though according to judgment, he does not deserve death. The verse is talking about reincarnation, which is what our class is tonight, but this is talking specifically about soulmates, where the cosmic soulmates have come into the world, but the man is not yet ready to marry his cosmic soulmate. And thus, she marries someone else. And then the time comes, because he's done his correction, he's done some work, spiritual work, and it has come time for him to marry his soulmate. But she is already married to someone. So what to do? The simple solution is a divorce. And that's why it's a mitzvah to get a divorce, because it saves a life. But sometimes when Hashem looks at the man and he sees that that man is truly in love with this woman, and would find it unbearably painful to see her with another man. So Hashem chooses to take the man out of this world, not because of his sins and not because of judgment, but because of mercy, so that he not see this woman that he loves so dearly being with another man, even though that man is more suited for her, because they are cosmic soulmates. Does anybody have any questions? Tonight is a special night for me. Tonight is the 22nd day of Elul. It's the 30th. Ilulah, the 30th Yortzeit of the death of my mother. And it is in her honor and in to elevate her soul to another higher level in the Garden of Eden that we are teaching this class. This class can be found on the Yeshem website at the Revealed Wisdom Matrix on row 11, and it's the second column from the left, the Advanced Reincarnation Series. And this is class number 24. So please click on the handout for class number 24. And we're actually talking about chapter 7, section 7. Are there any questions before we begin?
I missed the reference for the Zohar reading. Do you mind giving it again?
Let's see if I could find it again.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's the Vayelech, section 2, verse 7, I believe.
Okay, thank you.
Chapter 7, section 7 is titled Level 3 Splinters. And to remind you, we're talking about three levels of soul. Those souls who were in Adam and Eve and participated in the mistake, the chet, the sin, whatever word you wish to apply, although the word you apply is quite meaningful. And those souls fell into three categories. One, reincarnated. Another level of soul fell, left Adam and Eve before the sin and did not, it's as if they were never in Adam and Eve. So they never had an incarnation, is the way it is looked at. That is level one souls. Level two souls are those, like most of us, who didn't leave and participated in that action and fell spiritually along with all of the rest of the souls of Adam and Eve, the parts of the souls of Adam and Eve. And the third level fell into the klipot. They were so close and so involved in the action and in participating in the action, that they fell into the klipah. And we are talking about this third level of soul. The third level constitutes those souls that fell amongst the klipot after Adam sinned, from which came his son Seth and others. These are old souls, and the lowest of all of the types, because they fell from Adam and splintered into many sparks and pieces as a result of his sin. Since these souls had once been part of Adam, they are called old, meaning from a previous Gilgul. Their residence within Adam is considered a first incarnation. I just want to make one comment for you to kind of contemplate. Adam was created on Friday and sinned on Friday. And those souls left him on Friday, having never experienced the Shabbat. And yet it is considered that they had a full incarnation as being within Adam and with Adam as part of Adam's soul. When they were within Adam, they could have been rectified if he had not sinned. Consequently, their residence within Adam is considered a first incarnation. When any of them will come again into the body of a mortal human being, it will be the second incarnation of that soul. And that is why they are called old souls in Kabbalah, not in the more typical understanding of what is an old soul, a soul that has gone through many incarnations and has learned wisdom. That is not the way the system works, according to Kabbalah. When they come back in the body of a person who later dies, the soul is considered to have incarnated twice. Now, when a soul from this level comes into a body for the first time, it only has the ability to rectify a portion in each incarnation. As we've talked about, these old souls cannot rectify their nefesh and the ruach at the same time. Because in the second incarnation, the ruach must come separated into a different body than their nefesh. And their neshama must come into an even a third body, separate from the other two. The information in most of the rest of this section has already been taught previously. Indeed, this section is a wonderful summary and review of much of what has preceded it. The serious student might take the opportunity after this section to reread the preceding chapters. In the beginning, only a portion of the nefesh will come to be rectified. For example, if the nefesh was from the malchut of the nukva of Asiyah, then rectification will be necessary until the keter of Aliyah, the keter of Atzilut, is completed. Each part must be rectified until the tikkun of the entire nefesh is completed. When this has been accomplished, then the person will die and return in a second body with the ruach in order to complete its tikkun. When that tikkun is accomplished, then the person will die again and return in a third body with the neshama to achieve its tikkun. When this is done, then he too will die. However, no more reincarnations will be necessary. The nefesh needs to reincarnate as many times as it is necessary until it achieves rectification. We have already explained that when the ruach comes to be rectified, it does so clothed within the nefesh of a convert. The same is true regarding the neshama as well. Since a tainted ruach or neshama cannot come back clothed within a rectified nefesh or ruach, if the nefesh does not complete its tikkun, then it needs to reincarnate as many times as it is necessary until it achieves rectification. After that, the ruach will come into another body with the nefesh of a convert and will reincarnate by itself many times until it is complete. After that, the neshama will come by itself in yet another body, reincarnating many times, if necessary, until it is complete. If the nefesh, the ruach, and neshama are rectified, but then the person sins, causing a blemish to them, which necessitates reincarnation, as we have described, he will only be able to rectify either the nefesh or the ruach or the neshama each time. He will have to start again, but he cannot return with all three of them. There are those that reincarnate to rectify and guide the people of their generation. That is a different subject, a different concept that we're going to go into now. However, it may be that a person rectifies his nefesh, ruach, and neshama to the heights of Atzilut, and he reincarnates not for his own sake, but for that of another, since he neither sinned nor caused a blemish. He can retain in this Gilgul, even while still only a child, all that which he achieved previously. This is the secret of the son of Rav Hamuna Saba, mentioned in the Zohar in Parashat Balak. and the rest of the phenomenally righteous and wise children that are mentioned in the Zohar. They were complete from previous Gilgulim in all their nefesh, ruach, and neshama, and the other parts that were already rectified. This is new information, but it is surprising. If he is not coming for his own sake, but for someone else, then why is he reincarnating? And if he is coming as an Ibur, we have learned in chapter 5, section 1, and we will learn again in chapter 38, that an Ibur comes only after the age of 13 years and a day. To clarify this problem, we will translate a section from the Sefer HaGilgulim, the beginning of chapter 12, where the words of the Rav are more detailed and clearer. There are those that reincarnate for the sake of others, to rectify and guide the people of their generation. Some people like these are perfect tzaddikim that may have merited even the neshama of Atzilut or similar very high levels. They really do not need to reincarnate for themselves. They only reincarnate for the needs of the hour or the sake of others, to rectify and guide the people of the generation. These people can certainly achieve all their nefesh, ruach, and neshama together at one time, and all their other parts that were already rectified as well. This is the reason that we find young children whose deeds are wondrous, like the son of Rav Hamuna Saba in Zohar Vayechi, who is also the child in the Zohar Parashat Balak, and all the other wondrous children throughout the Zohar. These did not come to complete themselves, but for others. Therefore, they achieved nefesh, ruach, and neshama, and all that they had accomplished beforehand in one time. And that is why they were different and wondrous in their wisdom. I, Chaim, the writer, am in doubt, however, regarding those who must reincarnate, but not to rectify a sin, but to make up for a lacking. They had yet fulfilled some positive mitzvah, as opposed to actually transgressing a negative mitzvah. The question here is whether they will return with all their previously acquired levels or not. In Sefer HaGilgulim, in the chapter just quoted, the Rav answers, this question is in the affirmative and unequivocally. My commentary. The very idea that someone would reincarnate to help others is truly amazing. We must be very careful with this concept. We are created as a desire to receive. How can we do something that has no benefit to ourselves? We are taught in Kabbalah that our purpose in this world is to transform our desire to receive from selfishness to sharing. But clearly there is a benefit to doing so. Even if the benefit is unclear to us, there is a benefit. This is not altruism. In fact, one of the deeper teachings of Al-Kabbalah is that there cannot be altruism, since our essence is desire to receive. This applies even to the idea of Torah Lishma, Torah for its own sake. One cannot share even with the Creator without receiving. Thus, the idea of sharing with the Creator is considered receiving. This idea applies also to a subject in the Talmud dealing with engagement and marriage. Normally, the groom gives a ring to the bride, yet the subject is discussed that if the groom is a righteous person, a tzaddik, and also a Talmid Chacham, a wise man, She may give him the ring. By giving the ring, she receives the engagement. And thus the action is considered a kosher marriage. This takes a significant amount of contemplation. How does she receive by giving the ring? A human being is incapable of the altruism. Doing a sharing action without a desire to receive, the definition of altruism. There is a modern school of Kabbalah that translates the words of their teacher using the word altruism. This is impossible. So let me be clear. The teacher is teaching truth. The translation is a corruption, since the understanding of the English word altruism is not well understood by the translator. That is why my teachers and I use the exact term, desire to receive in order to share. It's a lot of words. It's kind of cumbersome, but it's very exact. This teaches us to be exact in our use of language, as well as to not think we understand when we use a translation. That's the end of section 7. Are there any questions? Chapter 7, section 8, spirits from the death.
Teacher, question.
Go ahead.
Are you familiar with the term Bodhisattva from Buddhism?
Bodhisattva?
I'm sorry, Bodhisattva from Buddhism?
I'm not familiar with it, no.
Okay. Well, they have basically the exact same definition of a soul that does not come back down into physical form but stays behind on the earth to help all of the others by being a spiritual mentor to them.
They come back down.
And
that's not what's being described here.
Yeah, they also can come back down and be in physical form.
Okay, that is what is being described here.
But they choose to, they can come back down and be channeled, and come back down in physical form, but they choose to come back down solely for the help of all the others. And I find it interesting that Buddhism has a very close definition to the Zohar.
There are many different paths to the Creator. And Buddhism does provide a path that is very, very close. But there is one distinctive difference.
What's that?
Buddhism, I'm not an expert in Buddhism. I haven't really studied the path, but as part of the process and by being a teacher, I've been exposed to some concepts in Buddhism. And as I understand Buddhism, as opposed to Hinduism, as I understand that aspect, they reach a highest level, which they refer to as nothingness. And Kabbalah indicates that that is a klipa that one must traverse to get to the highest levels.
Thank you.
Chapter 7, section 8, Spirit from the Depths. For the third level souls, meditation in the Tachanun prayer enables the coming of the Ruach, even while the Nefesh has not been completely rectified. In earlier sections of this chapter 7, we discussed how the Nefesh can complete its tikkun But the person doesn't have to die if it knows about this meditation that's done in the nighttime Shema, and that allows that Ruach to now come up with a nefesh of the ger, the nefesh of the convert. And the nefesh itself does not return into this body. But this is talking about something else. This is talking about the nefesh has not completed its correction. And yet the ruach is drawn into another body, when normally it should not be allowed to do so. Now we will explain the differences between level 2 and level 3 souls. The ruach of a level 2, made up of the sparks from Cain and Abel, cannot emerge from the depths of the klipot until the nefesh is rectified. Therefore, the tikkun to the ruach cannot occur through another person, but only through himself. He must either die, and his nefesh and ruach will afterwards come back in another body, as it was explained previously, or he can do it by himself with the meditation on the verse, "My nefesh has desired you at night." And we discuss that in section, chapter 3, verse, section 8. After the nefesh is rectified, it will leave, and the ruach will come by itself to become rectified, as mentioned earlier. It is likewise the same with the neshama. However, the sparks from level 3 have a different ability. Although they cannot achieve all levels in one lifetime, they can achieve tikkun using the proper meditations during the tachanun prayer. In other words, the souls of level 3 can grow from nefesh to ruach in one lifetime using the proper kavanah during the tachanun prayer. Tachanun is recited most weekdays during the morning and afternoon prayers and is a request for forgiveness of sins. In some communities at this time, it is customary to place one's forehead on the arm for a portion of this prayer, like one who is distraught and looking for forgiveness. The actual term the Rav uses in the text is nafilat apayim, which means falling on the face. You've heard that referred to as Moses and Aaron fell on their face. The language in the Hebrew is nafilat apayim. And this is a common nomenclature of the prayer as well. However, since tachanun is a more commonly known terminology these days, that term is used in the translation. He would meditate that he was entering into the lowest realms to extract from there the remnants of holy sparks. It is once customary that the person who is praying would fall prostrate on his face during this prayer. At that time, he would meditate that he was entering into the lowest realms, the realms of the klipot, to extract from there the remnants of holy sparks on their way to rectification. In our days, this practice is considered too holy. Is considered too dangerous, because the soul of the one who is praying may get caught there in the klipot. Therefore, at most in some communities, people have placed their forehead upon their arm. In other communities, the prayer is merely recited in a sitting position. I'll also mention something that we will get later on in this subject of reincarnation. And that's when a soul dies, it goes to Gehinnom, it goes to hell. Even the righteous people go to hell. They go to hell for an instant. And while they're in hell, they attract arcs of souls that when they leave hell and elevate to the Garden of Eden, they take with them these many different sparks of people who were sentenced to hell, but through their sharing consciousness and through their merit, these sparks are able to elevate out of hell. During the falling on the face prayer, they can meditate that they are extracting their ruach from the depths of the klipot. This works even if the nefesh is not yet fully rectified to ascend in the secret of Mayim Nukvim, female waters. This meditation is in the verse, to you, God, I lift up my soul. In the prayer, right, practiced by the Ari, and consequently adopted by all of the Sephardic Jews and some of the Hasidim and many of the Ashkenazim as well, this psalm is in place of Psalm 6 as the basic text of the Takanun prayer. His ruach is simultaneously being rectified in the body of another person. His ruach can then come during his lifetime into the body of another person who is born in combination with the nefesh of a convert. If he merits it, then it is possible to draw it into his own son, born to him. Therefore, even while the person is rectifying his own nefesh in his own body, his ruach is simultaneously being rectified in the body of another person who has the nefesh of a convert, or if he merits it, within the body of his own son. Through the meditation of the falling on the face prayer, only the ruach can be withdrawn from the klipah before the rectification of the nefesh is completed. This process of drawing out a higher level of soul before the nefesh has completed its tikkun only applies to the level of ruach. Under no circumstances can the neshama be drawn from the depths of the klipot until the nefesh and the ruach have been completely rectified. And those people who had the nefesh and ruach must die. Mm-hmm. Afterwards, the neshama can come in a gilgul to achieve tikkun. My commentary. This is one of the interesting aspects of the Kabbalah Center and its teachings, which are different than other paths of Kabbalah. The Kabbalah Center teaches that lighting a candle the night before for the hilulah of a righteous person, of a tzaddik, creates a condition that makes the Takanun prayer unnecessary. They do not say even when asked, yet this tzaddik must replace the ability to draw out the ruach prior to the completion of the tikkun of the nefesh, as taught in this section. This is an important teaching with respect to the hilulah connection of the various tzaddikim. It is why I strongly suggest one read the names of the tzaddikim who choose to leave on a particular day, since that day and that tzaddik may be your channel to elevate your ruach, as described above, even if you do not do the Takanun prayer. Are there any questions?
Yeah, what is the prayer? I missed that.
It's called the Takanun prayer. It's part of the Amidah service and the afternoon prayer service.
I can't hear very well on this phone. Could you repeat that?
It's called the Takanun prayer. It's part of the service and the afternoon prayer.
I can't catch that. I'm going to have to call you tomorrow on that. If you don't mind, I can't seem to hear very well right now on this phone.
No problem.
Yeah.
Are there any other questions? Chapter 7, Section 9, Rescuing Spirits from the Depths. When the Ruach is drawn down during the Nefilat HaPayim meditation, while the Nefesh is still completing its tikkun, then there are dangers for the one who has the Nefesh. During resurrection of the dead, the Nefesh and the Ruach will both arise within him. There is yet another thing to be clarified. I'm sorry, please say again. There is yet another thing to be clarified regarding this matter of the Ruach and the Nefesh that was just discussed. Since they can both come into the world in separate bodies, they are judged against each other in terms of who finishes his tikkun first. If the person who received the Ruach completes his tikkun prior to the person with the Nefesh, then he becomes the main one. Therefore, during resurrection of the dead, the Nefesh and the Ruach will both arise within him. However, if the one who possessed the Nefesh finished his tikkun first, then I, Rabbi Chaim Vital, do not recall what was said. However, it seems to me that I heard that during resurrection of the dead, they arise into the body that possessed the Nefesh, since he became the main one. There is another important distinction regarding the person who took Ruach during Nefilat HaPayim, before the final tikkun of the Nefesh. We have learned that if he completes the tikkun of Ruach before the one who has Nefesh completes its tikkun, that it may be that he will arise at the time of the resurrection of death with both the Ruach and the Nefesh. In such a case, there exists a very serious danger for the one who had the Nefesh. In such a case, the person merits through his actions, he can draw all the good of the Ruach to himself and leave the other evil. The Nefesh will lose all his merits to the one who is completing the Ruach. In other words, the one who had the Nefesh will lose all his merits to the one who is completing Ruach. The first will be left with evil only. Therefore, he will not arise in the time of the resurrection, and all his good and merits will go to the second one, who has the rectified Ruach. This is the secret of the verse. Let the evil of the wicked finish them, but you will establish the righteous. One whose deeds make him evil, he will finish by taking all the evil to himself. This is what it says, let the evil of the wicked finish them, while all the good is taken by the righteous person, whose actions have purified him. Thus he is finished and totally established, as it says, you will establish the righteous. It is known that a person is a combination of good and evil, purity within Klipah. Sometimes the evil is greater than the good, and the evil that is within him must be purified until all that remains is complete good. There are several mechanisms to accomplish this purification. What the Rav is having us contemplate here, since the evil is greater than the good, seems to be one of the more unpleasant possibilities. Thus I have heard from my teacher, may his memory be blessed, though I did not merit to understand this well. However, it seems to me that it is possible for the evil of the Nefesh and the evil of the Ruach to come together into one person whose actions are evil, and for the good of the Nefesh and the good of the Ruach to come to someone who has purified his actions, as mentioned above. Knowing this, you will be able to understand the next section titled The Danger Faced by King David. Kabbalah's my commentary. Kabbalah teaches that everyone will be resurrected, yet here it seems that it is possible for someone to not be resurrected. This issue relates to the body only, not the soul. Yet this is a very serious issue. The soul is considered the level of Zeranpin. The body is considered to be the level of Malchut. The soul is never destroyed. The body dies. What is the purpose of creation of something from nothing? It is the creation of desire. If desire is the purpose of creation, then the body is the most important aspect, at least as important as the soul. Thus, the loss of a body being resurrected is quite significant. There must be a solution to this issue. Perhaps this will be discussed or revealed later in the study. Are there any questions?
I'd like to ask you something. Thinking about the Takanun prayer, why is the longer version set on Mondays and Thursdays only?
Well, Monday it's set because it's the day of separation. The second day inherently is a day of separation. So you have this energy that is causing people to become separated, and you want to make a stronger argument, a stronger connection to the Creator to avoid separating within yourself and within your family. And the same thing will apply to Thursday, which represents the left column. It represents Hod, the left column of the Tree of Life, to the Sephiroth Hod. And that's why it's structured that way.
Okay, thank you.
Are there any other questions? Chapter 7, Section 10 is titled, The Dangers Faced by King David. Although his nephesh was intact, King David was in danger of losing his portion in the resurrection of the dead as a result of his sin with Bathsheba, because his ruach had entered the world while his nephesh was still completing its tikkun. My commentary. Please note that the Zohar says that King David did not sin with Bathsheba. The commentary above is from someone who may have been ill at the time of the making of the commentary, and made his commentary in a weak moment. In any event, read the balance of this section, of the commentaries in this section, with an open mind, and remember that King David did not sin with Bathsheba. Knowing this, you can understand what concerned King David when he said, "Many have said, for my nephesh there is no salvation for it from God." Selah. Knowing what was taught in the previous section, we will now be able to understand how King David could seem to be poised on the verge of destruction. It is strange that people should have spoken so badly about such a great person as King David. However, to understand this, we must be precise about what is written. It is written, there is no salvation for it, actually for him. It should have been written, there is no salvation for her. If it, the word it, referred back to the word my nephesh, mentioned at the beginning of the verse. The nephesh of King David descended to the Malchut of spiritual impurity. It is written in the verse, there is no salvation from God for it. At first glance, it would seem that the subject referred to by the pronoun it is the nephesh of King David that has no hope of salvation because of his sin with Bathsheba. However, the Hebrew word used for the pronoun it is lo, which refers to the masculine. If it were referring to the nephesh of King David, then one would have to use the feminine word la, because nephesh is a feminine noun. It will now be understandable, based upon what has been said, the nephesh of King David was very elevated. As a result of the primordial sin of Adam, it descended into the depths of the klipot on the side of the feminine, on the side of the nukva, of the klipot. In other words, it descended to the malchut of spiritual impurity. Malchut is the lowest of the sephirot, and the feminine side is generally below the masculine side. Therefore, at the least, we must understand that it descended very low indeed. When David was born, it was the first time it had left the klipot. Therefore, it began its tikkun only from the level of asiyah, which is called nefesh. The reason for this is that it was a gilgul from level 3. Like all third-level souls, the soul of King David fell from Adam into the klipot. However, this particular soul did not begin any tikkun whatsoever for many, many generations. Therefore, when it was reborn into a human body to begin the process of tikkun, it had descended to the lowest possible level. We often need to rule that the highest levels ascend to the lowest places, and things that were on the lowest levels must eventually ascend to the highest places. This is exactly the case of the soul that was born into King David. In the time of the resurrection of the dead, there would be no salvation for the body of King David. This is the secret of what is mentioned in Saba of Mishpatim in the Zohar, and many other places as well, that David was from the feminine side and not the masculine side. Rather, the origin of his soul was in the world of death that is called Nukvah. Understand this well. It is said of the Malchut Nukvah that her feet go down to death. This is a general characteristic of the feminine relative to the masculine in all places. Indeed, the soul of King David descended to such a... Please say again. Indeed, the soul of King David descended to such a low place that it was devoid of the ability to survive in this world even 1 second. But Adam gave it 70 years of his life. Thus it was asked there in the Saba of Mishpatim, why was he called Ovid? Ovid was the grandfather of David. He and his son Jesse, the father of David, made possible the birth of this soul that had sunk to the lowest of levels. The name Ovid means devotee or worker. The Holy Zohar in Saba of Mishpatim compares him to someone who is working on an orchard. His name derives from the fact that he did such good work rectifying the supernal tree that he became part of the line of Mashiach. The tree was lacking and he rectified it, is what the Zohar says. In other words, Ovid began the process of tikkun that resulted from the sin of Adam. And Zohar says that Jesse, David's father, continued the process, paving the way for King David to become king and prototype of Mashiach. However, since the tikkun was not complete, the ability of the soul of David to grow was limited in its first lifetime. The soul of David was immersed in the depths of the klipot of the nukvah. Since this was the case, David was only able to acquire his nefesh, leaving his ruach to become in the body of another person. When David sinned with Bathsheba, he blemished his nefesh. Although the Talmud teaches that David did not commit any formal sin, his behavior throughout the incident of Bathsheba was so dismal and disappointing for someone on the level that he had already attained that it amounted to a very serious setback to his spiritual progress. As a result, it became possible for the one who possessed his ruach to merit completion of its tikkun before David could rectify his nefesh. In the time of the resurrection of the dead, there would be no salvation for the body of David. The other body belonging to the one who had the ruach will take both the nefesh and the ruach. Consequently, this phenomenon that was originally considered a blessing becomes a curse. Originally, it was considered a good thing that the ruach can be made through kavanah to descend into a second body to be rectified there, while the nefesh is still undergoing tikkun in the first body. Nevertheless, there is a danger in this phenomena to the body and the person of the nefesh, as we have learned. The one with the ruach might finish its tikkun first and come to take both the ruach and the nefesh in the time of the resurrection of the dead. Apparently, this upheaval can occur if the evil committed by one with such an important and high nefesh is serious enough, or if he repeats the evil consistently enough. However, the nefesh itself will not be damaged, only the body. This is why he said that there is no salvation for it. Lo, meaning him. And not, there is no salvation for it. La, meaning her. There is no salvation for it refers to the body of David and not to his nefesh, which would require a feminine pronoun. This is the way the verse goes. Many say that since there is only a nefesh within me, she has no hope in the body of David at the time of the resurrection of the dead. My commentary. I hope you realize how amazing is this revelation. Personally, I was hoping to study with King David when the resurrection takes place. Do you think that this desire will be unfulfilled? Are there any questions?
How do we know if we get to be resurrected or not?
Everyone is going to be resurrected.
Everyone.
I've said that to you before. I've said that in classes before. Everyone will be resurrected. No exceptions.
Well, what about this nefesh and ruach type of thing?
This is saying the body will not be resurrected, but the nefesh and the ruach will be resurrected in another body, the body that corrected the ruach.
Mm-hmm.
Is the body important?
I don't know, is it? If you're supposed to be resurrected into that body, then isn't it important?
I don't know, is it? You have to decide for yourself. There's no answer to that question. Is the body important or not?
How can you be resurrected?
Where does your desire come from? Does desire come from your body or your soul?
person's soul?
Your soul has only one desire, to return to the Creator. Your soul has only one desire, let me out of this prison called the body.
Yeah. But why then is the body important? And you shouldn't burn the body.
Because the body was created by the Creator.
I thought because the body was important to be recreated.
The body is important. Is the soul more important than the body, or less important, or equally important?
Oh, all right. When we're talking important, more important, all right, is the soul.
So are we clear? Should I go on, or we still want to talk about this?
I
was wondering if the soul has one desire to get to the Creator, then why, after when it goes through the death process, that it tends not to want to leave the body right away?
Well, first off, which level of the soul are you referring to?
I guess whenever, right when you die and you go into the death process, whichever one that I guess that you're in, I guess. I don't know which one it would be, but I just always heard that it grieves. It kind of doesn't want to leave the body. And I was thinking, okay, if the soul has a desire to get to the Creator.
That is why I'm asking. Because when you start to use questions, you need to know what you're asking. You need to know what level you're talking about.
Okay.
When someone dies, 30 days before they die, their neshama leaves their body. It's not there at the moment of death. The ruach leaves the body and goes with the shekhinah. And the nefesh is drawn out of a desire for the shekhinah and then regrets it. And that is the part of the soul that is moving back and forth between the grave and the home during the week of Shiva. Why does the nefesh not want to leave the body?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's connected more to the body than the other levels of soul. The other levels of soul wouldn't be in the body unless, except for the nefesh. And the nefesh, it's like one metaphor to understand it. You have two sisters, one's 5 and one's 6. They're much closer than two sisters that are 3 and 12. The body and the nefesh are like very close sisters. And they've spent 30, 50, 80, 100 years together. The nefesh has become sullied and dirtied by the body's desire to receive for oneself alone. And now it's afraid of going into Gehinnom and going through the cleansing process that it knows it has to go through. And that's why some of the nefeshot, don't want to go down that tunnel of light into the Garden of Eden, into the Shekhinah. And they run away from that process. And that's where you get souls that are, you know, running around the universe, the physical world's universes.
Is that how they get locked into the physical world?
What was the question?
Is that what happens, that they get like locked into the physical world because their soul doesn't want to leave?
They have to find a place to hide from the pursuers. The pursuers are angels who or demons who have a job to do, and that's to pursue these runaway souls and bring them through the proper process. So the soul who does that has to find a place to hide. It's very hard to hide from the pursuers. Go ahead.
Question. So how is it that these souls, after they pass, can hide if the pursuers are so good at pursuing?
Because the pursuers cannot go into a human body. And so sometimes we have what's called a dvuk, where one of these souls has entered another body and taken control of that body by virtue of its fear and strength overpowering a weaker soul within that body.
You mean they can't do that?
Who can't do that?
I know that a soul could enter another body without being placed in
them. They're not supposed to, and that's why they're called dvuks. And that's why you have concepts like, exorcisms. But it's very few, very unusual, because the pursuers are very effective. The soul doesn't stay in the body because he's constantly at war with the soul that belongs there. So sometimes he wants to get out of that chaos. And as soon as he steps out of the body, the pursuers are there to catch him. Please don't get lost in this. It's an interesting subject that isn't interesting. It just takes you down a path of lengthening your process. There are very few need for exorcism. It doesn't happen often. Any other questions?
Yes, I have one. I don't know if there's a relationship between a family line that comes to an end. Let's say that, you know, this family line has the name of, I don't know, Jones, and there are no more descendants to carry on that name anymore. Is there some relationship to a tikkun being finished, or is that just the way things happen?
I'm going to ask you to clarify your question, because I'm trying to teach people to use the language of Kabbalah. Exactly. So you have a family named Jones, and you have a man and a woman who are married together. Do they have daughters only? And therefore the name Jones dies out because there's no sons? Or
right.
Do they have no children? Which is your question applying to?
Okay, well, I know of both instances. We're one family.
We all know both instances. My question to you is, which one do you want answered from now?
It doesn't matter. Whichever one you want to answer.
If it doesn't matter, then it's not worth answering the question.
I still didn't understand you. You broke up.
If it doesn't matter, it's not worth answering the question.
Well, maybe I worded that wrong. Either one you choose to answer, because I know of both of those situations.
I don't have the desire for the question. You do. You're asking the question.
Yeah.
So which one do you want to know?
Okay, the one who had no sons, just daughters.
So there's no loss of the family line.
Okay, because the daughters could be reincarnated.
The daughters will reincarnate.
Okay.
As well as the daughters have souls that will join with other souls and draw and create other children. And the line continues. It's just the patriarchy that says, oh, it's important to have a family line that follows the male. But there mm-hmm. are matrilineal, wrong word, but you know what I mean. There are societies that follow the descent of the women. So it's just a cultural bias. Not all cultures follow the descent of the male.
Aren't in the instance that the couple that has no children. I don't know if that's what you're trying to get at. I don't know what you're trying to get at. But
I'm trying to get you to be exact in your question. That's what I'm trying to get at.
Well, see, I'm trying not to.
When you first asked the question, so now
okay, I was trying not to name. You know, I'm a detail person, and I was trying not to name names, and that's probably why I was more vague.
No names involved in either case. It was just being exact. What were you referring to? So your first question that you finally addressed was a married couple die, both people die with only daughters. Therefore, their family name that follows patrilineal descent dies out. And you're asking, does that mean that there's a tikkun finish? The answer is no. Now you're asking, if they both die without children at all, is there a tikkun being finished? And the answer is, the man who dies without children, according to the Zohar and other writings, that man is stuck in a place that makes it difficult to reincarnate. And his tikkun is lengthened and not completed.
More than likely,
the woman that he's married to is not his cosmic soulmate.
So then what helps them to get out of that place to reincarnate? If they have no children, these males pass on without children.
What helps them get out of it is the prayers of those righteous people of their generation.
Those people have to see that the prayers are said for them.
Righteous people of a generation take responsibility to help all souls within a generation. So those righteous people will pray for people in that situation without being asked. They know that people die like that, and they also know that it's their responsibility to pray for them.
Do they have to mention their names if they don't know them?
They know them quite well. A true tzaddik knows every member of the generation. You're living with limitations of physicality, and I'm dealing with souls. There's no limitations on the souls. I know every one of you, and I've not met half of you. How do I know you? Because there's no limitation on it. Have you looked for me in your dreams? Have you seen me? Have I seen you when you come to ask me questions? stop limiting yourself with your physicality. And that's the point I was trying to get across to you, Bacha. If you don't ask the question properly, you're never going to get the proper answer. If you don't use the proper vocabulary, then the answers are going to come to the vocabulary you ask.
When you're in a baby stage with reincarnation, a baby has a hard time wording questions.
I will give you an answer, and I'm not disagreeing with you, but I will give you an answer that one of my student teachers gave me. When I said, but I don't really have to do that particular mitzvah in that way, because after all, I'm the newbie at this. I didn't know that before yesterday. And he said, but you know it today. You can only use the explanation that you're a newbie, that you're still a baby in this thing for so long. We've been doing this now for 6 months. This is the 24th class. I am asking you to step out of limiting yourself and asking the proper questions. And I'm sorry that I embarrassed you with it today. I don't mean to.
You didn't embarrass me. You didn't embarrass me.
But it's important that people start to use the proper vocabulary. And it's also important that people not stop asking questions. But a lot of times I have to interpret what your question is. And that means you're not getting the answer that you want. It is appropriate for what you're really asking.
Question.
Go ahead, Bob.
How long do you have to pray for a soul?
Bernice, is your name Bob?
What?
Bob asked a question, and you interrupted him. So please wait.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Your
I didn't realize somebody else was asking. Okay.
That's okay. So my other question kind of related to Bacha's question. You know, we're talking about a family lineage and reincarnation and the importance of whether or not the body lineage continues on in a name. And I've had that thought also in a question. Is with so many different variations in the human DNA on the planet, with so many different physical lines of heritage, right, in families, and knowing that souls just want to reincarnate and that the families are just vehicles for them to do that, an opportunity for them to do that, is it really even important that a family lineage continues or doesn't continue? Are there a lot of families that can just as well die out and without making a big impact on the universe?
Well, first off, you made a statement that I need to clarify. The soul does not want to reincarnate. The soul wants to complete its tikkun and get out of this prison.
Right.
The soul wants to return to the Creator. Now, is it important? The souls choose the parents, and to the extent that the parents have siblings for them, the souls are choosing that family as the best mechanism for them to learn their life lesson in this incarnation.
I'm with
that
you.
Is
so,
the purpose
I think
of family. But let
yes.
me finish
so
that. That's the purpose of family, and that applies until the age of 20. After 20, the only purpose of family is for people to either create chaos in their life by trying to get along with people that they don't get along with, or learning to love by getting along with people because they're family. But in truth, each of us is family with every other human being, correct?
Yeah.
So why, when we limit it to just a family, is that a proper approach? And yet there are many people that will tell you that that is the proper approach, that the history of the family is important. You have a whole industry that created out of researching where the parents immigrated from. I think they're charging $25 a month per person. How many people do they get to pay that? Is it wrong that they do it? Of course it's not wrong.
I think they're doing that for to find ancestry for having a soul council, right? But I think in order to answer in an attempt to answer Botch's question, I think if a family doesn't have a male child, if it's in a male dominant society, right? And if there are so many, if there's so almost countless many souls out there waiting to incarnate, then no one wanted that bloodline to continue. It was in no one's best interest if it didn't continue. Is that the way to look at it?
That is one way to look at it, yes.
Because there were so many different families out there.
That's the only way to look at it. It doesn't mean it's the only way to look at it, but it is one way to look at it. I mean, personally, I only have daughters. And the Zohar and the Ari are very clear that a person who has only sons or only daughters, because you need to have one of each in order to return. Okay, excuse me. You have to have one of each in order not to return. So someone who only has daughters or only has sons has to return in an incarnation. Now, other sages, that applies. You can have a daughter in one generation, one life, one incarnation, and you can have a son in another incarnation. And you don't have to repeat yourself because you've already had one of each. And then there are others who say, no, it's each lifetime on its own. So I am operating on the basis that I have to come back so I can do whatever I want. Because I don't have to worry about it. I mean, I have to come back anyway. That was a joke, people.
I was laughing and muting.
I have a question. Esther going to stay here for 300 years?
Say again?
I thought you were going to stay for 300 years.
Wait, what does that have to do with anything?
You won't need to come back.
Yeah, do you think I can get some 40-year-old woman to marry me when I'm 120? So
maybe.
That I can have a son. But then I can rely on the teacher. I can rely on the writings that say that my students are my children. And so therefore, I don't have to have another child because
that's
I already have
true.
Male students.
There you are. Yeah. But you've had your children.
Yes, I've only lived 300 years. And I do have two daughters, and they have four sons and one daughter that are my
That's
grandchildren,
right.
Which is a pleasure.
So you're balanced. God bless you.
Any other questions? Or can we finish the... there's only one more section to go through. Chapter 7, Section 11, Transferring Merit. One can lose his portion in the resurrection of the dead by transference of all the good to one soul partner and transference of all the evil to the other one. There is another explanation to the verse mentioned above. Let the evil of the wicked finish them, but you will establish the righteous. It can sometimes happen that a person's nephesh will not enter him wholly and completely. Some of the good with most of the evil that is within it will go into the body of another person. The one who is mostly good will have the ability to draw all of that good to himself. These two will then become friends. The one who is mostly good will have the ability to draw all of the good to himself. The entire portion of evil will be banished to the mostly evil person. Regarding the second person, it says, let the evil of the wicked finish them. Concerning the first person, it says, you will establish the righteous along the lines of what was said in the first explanation. It might also be that both of them are equally balanced. If one of them commits a sin, and definitely if the second one also performs a mitzvah, then he will overcome his friend. He will begin to draw the good to himself little by little until the good is completely by him and the evil is completely by the other one. The Rav will now provide an explanation for a difficult passage in the Talmud, which will also describe how the good was completely taken from a person who was then left with only evil. With this, you can understand what the sages meant when they wrote, Ahab was balanced, and when it says all the hosts of heaven stood by his right and his left, which was said regarding King Ahab, although the evil sometimes overpowered him, still the nephesh itself was all half good and half bad. The Talmud teaches that the heavenly tribunal met to decide what to do with King Ahab. The angels that stood on the left were prosecutors demanding punishment. The angels that stood on the right were defenders recalling merit. The Rav brings the teaching of the Talmud that Ahab was balanced and that he had the ability to repent and rectify all of his sins until he murdered Nabot. It was the spirit of Nabot that decided the judgment against Ahab and led him to destruction. Is this not amazing? It says that the lightest sin of Ahab was like the worst sin of Jeroboam. The prophet many times writes that not only was King Jeroboam a sinner, but he also caused the entire nation to sin. It was he who built the golden calves in Bethel and Dan, which eventually caused the exile and the disappearance of the 10 tribes of Israel. In one place, the Talmud states that the lightest sin of Ahab were equal to the worst sins of Jeroboam. Yet on the same page, the Talmud teaches, as we have read, that Ahab was equally balanced. The Talmud seems to contradict itself. How could they call him balanced? Rather, it is like this. His actions were not balanced, but rather they leaned in the direction of guilt. However, his nefesh was balanced, half good and half bad. Although the evil sometimes overpowered him and he worshipped idols, still the nefesh itself was half good and half bad. Thus, it could be that at the same time that a person's actions are terrible and horribly sinful, his nefesh could still retain a large repository of good, and the balance sheet of his Gilgul could still finish in Tikkun. This is very encouraging. Therefore, God did not reject him completely, but rather wanted him to repent. He might do good, and that is why Elijah the prophet chased after him in order to bring him back into Teshuvah until the incident of Nabot, from the Jezreel Valley. My commentary. This section is truly difficult to understand and to reconcile. In my opinion, the commentator did not succeed in this explanation. Let us delve a little deeper into the story. I believe the commentator did not take us deep enough to understand what he was saying. This is another indication of his illness at the time of the commentary. King Ahab was married to Queen Jezebel. The man Naboth was a farmer who owned a vineyard next to the property of King Ahab. King Ahab desired this property for something selfish. He had the space in his own vineyard to accomplish his desire, but he did not want to disturb his own vineyard. His queen Jezebel asked him what disturbed him. He told her he tried to buy Naboth's vineyard and was rebuffed, and this depressed him. Jezebel asked him to let her handle the matter. King Ahab gave into this desire to receive for oneself alone and abdicated his actions to the queen. This is the sin that is light, yet weightier than the building of the idols in the northern kingdom of Israel. I suggest you read this in the book of Kings, then contemplate how it applies to you in this period of Teshuvah that we're in right now. Does anybody have any questions?
No.
It's an interesting aspect of the story of Naboth is that when God asked, how are we going to get Naboth to punish himself through his actions, that the soul of Naboth came forward and said, I will lie to him. I'll go to him as somebody and I will give him a lie that will cause him to make a big mistake. But God is a God of truth. And yet, the plan that would motivate the king Ahab to do what is the best for him, which was to be cleansed through death, took a lie. And that soul of Naboth was so upset and angry at the way he was treated that he agreed to lie, that he came up with the plan to lie, and therefore he could no longer go into God's presence until after his next incarnation. Because God is a God of truth. And even though he allowed this plan to go forward, it wasn't one of his happier ideas. There's a lot in the book of prophets that people just don't read. They don't understand. They don't make the connection. Any other questions? Everybody have a beautiful, beautiful week. And I do apologize if I have upset anybody or harmed anybody in this issue of choosing the right language as you ask questions. I hope you're all well.
Okay, thank you. See you later so much.
Have a beautiful week.
You too.
Shalom.
Shalom.
Shalom.